March 3rd, 2020, session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. Sorry. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been doing a couple of things. I did get my Raspberry Pi working and got it actually compiled both Pi HPSDR, and I did try Lin HPSDR, and I'm missing one component on Lin HPSDR, but it seems to work fine on a Raspberry Pi 4, so that was one little task done.
User joined your channel.
Few other projects that I've been working on, but that's about it for me this week. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, everyone. Just looks like folks are just landing. I have been messing around with the extender functionality of the magnetometer devices, and it's at this point it seems to be working well. I had some doubts at first, but I have 24 hours of uninterrupted data that I recorded through a 100-foot Cat6A Ethernet cable, and without any visible sign of lost data. Started to work today on making up some more boards, but trying to use stencils and stencil solder application and related things, and didn't do so well so far, but I kind of expected that to start slowly. Not sure whether that's going to be helpful or not. Anyway, things are moving along. Need to work on code, but that's pretty much it for me. Over to you, Dave.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Mike AAAK shown as recording and Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Next on the list, we have N8WQ with Mike muted, and I don't know N8's name. So since he has his mic muted, we'll skip over him. Next, we'll have Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thank you very much, Dave. Things are going fine here in Scranton, just very, very busy. I am trying to get the Hamsite workshop agenda posted. I should have the tentative agenda posted within the next 5 minutes. So hopefully on the next round, I'll have that up, and I'll hopefully have the abstract book up tonight as well. W2NAF, back to net.
Fine business. And next we have Rob, AI6VN. Go ahead, Rob. Rob, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can
hear sorry. You. I'm sorry. I had to run out the room here. Yes, I'm not sure. I've been away for weeks now, so I don't know where you guys are at. And what I'm working on primarily has been maybe indirectly of use to you guys in the end. We've been investigating the WhisperNet database, which has went down quite a bit recently. And as part of my software development effort, we decided we needed to we had more data to put in. So we've been investigating various real-time databases and stress testing them and learning about the data recording and querying parameters that are required. So we've been learned quite a bit about that area. We haven't settled on something yet. There are on the reflectors, a couple of guys were good suggestions, influx and time something. So we're looking at a database that I think would be of a size relevant to the Space Weather Project. I mean, we're taking the WhisperNet archives and loading up a month or 2 months. A month has about 60 million observations in it right now. So it's about 2.5 gigabytes each month. So Influx has proved to have problems with some of the data, puts it into conniption fit. So we're looking at another. I think this would be relevant in the end to the Space Weather Project, which is, I guess, indirectly relevant. That's been my focus recently.
Okay, Rob. Thank you. Next on the list, we have Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, very good evening to you, Dave, and everyone on the group. Got the first artwork back for the receiver module. It's a six-layer board, and there'll be a few more tweaks to it, but it looks pretty good so far. And we had a review of that with the layout guy and got the, at least PDFs of the various six layers. So lots going on. Back to the group.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. And thanks again for running the group here. It's always appreciated. And also thanks to Mike for recording and posting. This week, or last week, I guess, I was out of town most of the week doing some work in, of all places, Orlando. So it was interesting. There's an awful lot of work going on here. And then, as Tom said, we've got the final artwork in. Well, not the final, but we got check blocks in with the routed RF board, RF module. And it looks pretty good. I have a couple questions for Tom. And we get to the general session, but otherwise it looks pretty good. We had, like I said, we had to grow it 5 millimeters or maybe 15 millimeters, depending on how long you really thought it was originally. I believe it's 115 millimeters long now, but looks very good. And thanks much to Tom for all his diligent efforts in keeping the ground plane separated and keeping us all in line on that, because it's it was a pretty complicated design. Simple, but yet complex. Got to avoid the pitfalls of noise coupling and things like that. So appreciate Tom's expertise there. That's about it for this week. Back to you, Dave.
Fine business, Scotty. I have noticed a couple places we're starting to get requests to buy the boards. They're a little ahead of the curve, but I figured we ought to invite them to come and help build the boards. Next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Fine business. Do you copy me okay? I've got this weird headset.
You seem to be coming through fine.
Okay, very good. Well, I spent most of the week continuing to work on splitting up the... I had been doing everything through a single channel pair. The communications between the data engine and the local host, it's just simulated, of course, but I've got the software almost working where it does its work through a separate pair of virtual channels, a pair of ports for the command, a pair of ports for configuration, a pair of ports for data. That's been, I'm just starting to get that working even as we speak here. My system crapped out when you called for Nathaniel. Did Nathaniel ever show up on this on the net tonight yet?
Yes, he has.
Okay, I did want to touch base with him on a couple of topics regarding the HAMSCI workshop when it comes to that, and I want to check with Scotty regarding whether he received what I sent him on the
user
communications protocol between the data engine and the local host. So we'll come back to that. But I am making slow but steady progress on the software. Also, I would like to talk with Rob a little bit regarding his some of his thoughts on the database, because that's something we've thought a lot about, and be a good idea to join forces on those. Okay, back to net.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Dan, N4XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay, thank you, Dave, and good evening, everyone. Well, I've spent the last 5 or 6 days fighting off a head cold, which is getting a little bit better now, but didn't for a number of days, so haven't really accomplished much this week. Anyway, back to you, Dave.
Fine business. And that brings us to the end of the list, although N8WQ has added Orville to his name, so we now know his name. So I think that we've come to the end of the list, and we're open for general discussion.
Yeah, I have a quick announcement, just to make sure everyone's aware. Next week, we switch to a different time because daylight savings time kicks in on Sunday. So we will be meeting, I guess, the same local time. So I guess it doesn't matter for everyone else. But for us here in Arizona, it's an hour earlier.
It's usually Arizona, Indiana, and the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think Indiana has finally gone to daylight savings.
Well, then it's just you and the rest of the world. User was moved to
your channel. Oh, now I'm over here.
Yeah. Yeah, I think David just joined us too.
David, do you, N1HAC, do you have any comments?
Well, I'm just curious how to get on. I always get stuck in the default channel and can't get over into here.
It usually helps if you make a bookmark, which is the second line, and I have to look at my bookmarks. But you add a bookmark, and I have one for Tangerine, Tangerine TeamSpeak server, and then I have all my settings and what's the default directory, and also this one has a different port number than the usual TeamSpeak port number, so you can set all those things there, and then you don't have to remember them.
What's the correct port number?
User disconnected from your channel. User entered your channel.
Sorry. 7388.
Yeah. Okay, I have that as a bookmark, but I guess I didn't know to use that.
So you
haven't been on here very much lately.
You Sorry. Can put all that in there so that you just click the bookmark and it sends you there.
Okay, now I see that I have that bookmark in there. Okay, good.
And then there's a default channel in that bookmark that you can enter.
Okay.
But you should be able to just grab your entry with a mouse and drag it down into the Tangerine SDR group.
No, that's what I was trying to do, and it was not working. It never has for me. I go into default channel, and I'm just stuck there in limbo.
Scotty, that's because Scotty has superpowers.
Yes.
You can also double-click on Tangerine SDR at the top of the list, and that will take you to that to our group, out of the default channel into our group.
Well, I'm in here now. Let's see where that goes. Thank you.
No problem. And Dave, it is right. We go to 0200 Zulu next week. Right. Is that correct?
Oh, that is correct.
Oh, cool.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Dave. Go ahead. Please finish.
Yeah, we are going to be daylight time, and so we just keep this same time but in daylight time. So for whatever your local time is, just stay on the same local time. It's the U.S. We're not good enough at switching times like other people.
Yeah, that's why we should use Zulu time, then you know exactly when it's supposed to be, except it's on the wrong day, so you still have to figure that out.
So right now, we're 2 o'clock UTC, and next week we'll be at 1 o'clock UTC.
Okay, that's what I was asking. So it was previously at 0200, now it's going to be at 0100. So just want to make sure everybody got that. For those of you listening on the
Are we already going to daylight savings time?
Next Sunday.
Ah!
That's not this Sunday. That's the 8th of March we go to daylight savings.
Yeah,
well, I guess that is this coming Sunday.
Of course, any time is too early to me.
Should move to Arizona. We never go to daylight savings time.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, this will be great. We have sunlight right now as we start, and next week we'll have sunlight as we finish.
I don't. Some of us are ghosts.
Bill, I got your documents. They look absolutely awesome. I got a couple comments I want to make. I'll send you something in the next day or so.
Say, I have a question for everybody. I found another video on the ionosphere from NASA Goddard. It's in the Tangerine comments. It is a cartoon, but it does a fairly good job of talking about how the ionosphere affects people. So I was thinking of using that is in a web page. Why are we doing all these things building radios? And add that to the website.
Sorry about that, Scotty. My system died when I tried to say okay when you're on your last comment. I wasn't hanging up on you or anything.
Okay, yeah, I saw you. You got dumped there. So hey, very good. Well, I'll send you some comments the next day or two. And Dave, the video looks interesting. Is that something you want to put on our website or on HamSci or where?
I would put it on our website, just linking to the video, and make it a why are we doing this webpage for Tangerine SDR. And I didn't know, I think we ought to put some comment on our website where the Tangerine SDRs will be eventually sold, and I assume that's Tapper.
Yeah, that's correct. And I know predominant things for the HamSci conference is when can I get one?
Where's the link for the video?
On the bottom there, click on the Tangerine SDR tab and it'll show.
And then you'll see one that says NASA Goddard.
No, I don't. This is not going well tonight.
You see at the very bottom of your screen, you have two tabs. One called
I'm in the Tangerine SDR tab. What time did you post that?
2010-09.
Oh, it's way back.
It's only the third one back.
Oh.
Those times show in local time, so it's 21:10.
I think it's because I didn't get on that it isn't showing up.
No, it should show up unless you have the left-hand tab open. Server tab open, you won't see it. You have to have the Tangerine SDR tab open on the very, very bottom of the screen.
No, it's not giving me the back history. Maybe I refresh.
Want to post it again, Dave?
Yes, I'll post it again.
Yeah, please. Thank you. This is frustrating. Now I see it. Thank you.
Since we're encouraging students, I thought this might be better than a dense academic paper.
Yeah, I think it looks really nice, Dave. Yeah, I've never seen this one before.
I also wanted something that described how the ionosphere was important to radio signals.
Did everybody just go silent, or did I lose my connection again?
You're there, Bill. We just, one of those dead moments.
Okay, I got a question for Nathaniel.
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
I sent you that an abstract. Now, how long of a talk are you looking for from me?
About 20 minutes summarizing in the status of the University of Alabama part of the project.
Okay, very similar to what I gave in Orlando.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, now just here, be prepared. You're familiar with that saying, I know. The university has started telling people they can't travel to certain areas due to the epidemic that's going on. Now, are you going to have an option if someone cannot make it, who's scheduled to talk, that they'll be able to dial in and give their talk remotely and have it be seen and heard by the conference attendees?
Yes, we will. We're going to use Zoom. So it'll be very similar to the Thursday afternoon telecon. So we do have a contingency plan.
All right. Just making sure on that. That was the main thing I wanted to just check on. Okay, back to Ned.
Yeah, and Nathaniel, did you get my piece as well?
Let's see. Did you send it this afternoon?
Sent it this morning.
This morning. I have to double check on that. I didn't get a chance to get caught up on all my email today yet.
All right. Yeah, I sent it a little bit before 11 this morning.
And not to my Facebook account.
What's that?
And not to my Facebook account.
Not to the Facebook account. To scranton.edu.
Right. I am still looking for it.
10:39 a.m.
Okay, yes. A system has been developed and is being deployed around the Northeast using an SDR and Raspberry Pi to receive and measure Doppler shift of the carrier frequencies. Okay, yes, I have it.
Got it. Thanks.
You are welcome. And I just posted the program for the Hamsai workshop on the website, and the link is in the bottom of the Tangerine SDR chat window as well.
Very good. Looks like a great job, Nathaniel.
Thank you. I'm still working on getting the abstract book put together. I'm just trying to, I'm using Microsoft Access for this, and I have a few things I'm trying to debug, but I'll hopefully have it up tonight. And yeah, I've
so
gotten.
So you said it was posted.
I have
it. Was posted on the website.
It's posted on the website, and it's also on the. There's also a link in the Tangerine SDR chat.
That's funny. I don't see it in the chat window. That's kind of odd. I usually see all those. Oh, there it is, up at the top there.
And if you go to hamsai.org/hamsai2020, if you go scroll down to program, there should be links there now too.
Yeah. By the way, Nathaniel, the title you have on mine is you have travelining ionospheric disturbances.
Oh, I'll have to fix that.
It's a new phenomenon.
Okay, I have it fixed in Access. I just need to update the PDF.
All right. It looks like a great agenda, Nathaniel.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to it.
Trying to get out there and back before COVID-19 catches up with all of us.
I know. So I've gotten at least, I got an email from you today, and I got a couple from Phil Erickson today about that. So I know Scranton, the university, does have a health and safety or community health department, and they do have an official statement on travel with the COVID virus. And so I'm going to contact them tomorrow and see how this impacts the workshop. And I'm going to follow the university's guidance on what to do.
Yeah, we just got our first confirmed in the our area in New Hampshire.
Yeah, well, there's only one reported case in Arizona, and it's in the town I live in. So that's not a good sign, is it?
Now, the other strange thing for us is that my mother used to be at the facility in Kirkland, Washington, where the big outbreak is. She's now passed away, but that cuts a little close to home.
Well, the big outbreak's only like 3 cases, right?
No, they have a lot more, and they've had 2 or 3 die already at this nursing home.
Oh, okay. This is in Washington?
Yeah, the Kirkland, Washington one.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like fun. You know, I have been worried about, if not the COVID thing, which just, came up over the past, month or so. But I've also always been worried about snow at this time of year. So yeah. I know March is, it can be hit or miss. It's usually okay, but it's also really possible to get a real walloper of a snowstorm. So that could be a possibility also. So I am planning on having a contingency plan of switching things over to a Zoom meeting format if we have to.
That's good to do that.
Are those Zoom sessions recordable?
Yeah, I believe so.
Might have some advantages.
I used to host a meeting here in February that more times than not was snowed out, so we moved it to April, so we get snow in April now.
That sounds about right. Yeah, whether we do the Zoom teleconference or the in-person, we should have a video recording. In person, Jason Johnston is supposed to be doing that.
So Jason is coming then?
Yes, he is.
All right, good. And my hotel and all my reservations are in order, but I don't think I signed up on the website. Do I need to do that?
I will send you a link to do that.
Okay, thanks.
Have you guys discussed the magnetometer part of it yet today?
Not especially, except just what I've been doing lately personally.
Yeah, I was hoping I'd get on a little earlier. You see the piece that I sent about different types of Ethernet cable?
Yes, I did. I thought that was interesting. The Ethernet versus the HDMI cable, I believe it was.
Well, it's actually different forms of Ethernet cable. I discovered this when looking into sending video on Ethernet cable long distances, and apparently they twist regular Ethernet cable different amounts to control crosstalk, but that creates a skew in the signals that is not good for video and would not be good for the I2C either. So that might be what you're running into when you're getting to 100 feet.
Well, I think it appears that we've solved resolved the issues, at least all of them I've encountered so far on the 100 feet. My initial problem was that I was mostly relying on an NVIDIA Xavier, which appears to default to about a 1 megabit per second I2C. Either that or else it uses a 1.8 volt. I did just decided not to fool with it and went to the N2, the Odroid N2, which everybody's using, and that's been working fine. I've got 24 hours of continuous data that I recorded until about midday today, and it does not seem to have dropped anything so far as I can see. There's timestamps with it, just too much to look at.
So what data rate does that default to, or do you have it running at?
I had set it to 100K. I don't remember. That may have been the one that defaulted higher to 400, but 100K is what we were specifying, and so I tried to work with that.
That certainly makes a big difference. If you wanted to play with that other cable, though, I think I was seeing it on Amazon. When you go look at video interfaces, you find out all of this.
I'll have a look at it. It's just something worth knowing. I knew they used different amounts of twisting over the years for different categories of cable, but didn't know about the video thing.
Yeah. So they make cable that'll has minimum skew, which would be good for this kind of application.
Yeah, I think that particular cable may not make any difference in this app. The timing is limited by the round trip time. The master has to send out the clock, wait for the receiver to get it, and the receiver then has to send back the data. And so the big issue is the round trip time, and that's why running at 100 kilobits per second makes that work, because it allows enough time for the data to get clock to get out and the data to get back.
Yeah, it'd be best if it used just off-the-shelf wire, of course.
Yeah, it should be able to and not care about any special requirements at all.
The stuff I'm using was $29.95, I believe, for the 100 foot from Amazon, and it got it like overnight, and it seems to work well. It seemed to work at 400K. It even tried to work at 100 at whatever the higher speed was. It just didn't work, or if either higher speed or lower voltage, I don't know. It tried, but it didn't quite do it.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting a hold of one of those to try out over here. What's the schedule on having them available?
That'll be slow. These I'm building by hand, and they're so far I have one set that works, and I've destroyed one set of boards trying to make them work, and I have another one today that I'm started on, and it doesn't work yet, but it probably will before I'm done.
Oh, thank you.
I expect the first pair will go to Hillman and his people for checking it, Jenny Jump, since he's made that request. And otherwise, for just measuring the magnetometers, I have some simpler ones that are much easier for me to make.
I had a comment from my discussion with Dolores last week, and she suggested that we have metadata when people use these to take a panorama picture like with a cell phone, at the location where the magnetometer sits, and that could be used later for debugging anomalies.
That sounds like an excellent idea.
I just wanted to get that. It's something that she told me, and I didn't comment on it last week, and I wanted it to at least get in the recording.
Is that to diagnose cases where somebody walks up with an anvil next to the magnetometer?
Yes, and whether people in this group can be sensitive to issues of putting a magnetometer next to something, and not all people that will be using this will be sensitive to that issue.
Yeah, one thing that someone who understood the physics of all this better than I do could enlighten me on is, are these sensitive simply to the presence or absence of static magnetic fields, or is it only changing ones? So that if, say, someone mounted it with some nails or some other diamagnetic material, is that a serious problem, or a steel bracket? I'm sure it's preferable not to, but obviously a motor or something nearby is going to be a big problem. But I didn't know about a single, a static, non-moving, magnetically susceptible material.
Yeah, Dave, my guess would be that it will measure a static magnetic field. And so that's it'll have to be placed, in sufficiently in the clear. The question is, will the nail disturb it? Not sure. I remember reading that the pins that you use to plug the magnetometer into the motherboard needed to be not terribly magnetic.
Yeah, I read that too. And that guy was a physicist in England, so he may have known what he was talking about.
That said, I seem to recall that the magnetometer does have a low-pass filter on it, so that it's not necessarily going to be highly sensitive to things like your if you have transmission lines nearby, just the 60-cycle hum. It's supposed to screen that out, if I recall correctly. Somebody may correct me on that.
Are you referring to the magnetometer support board that I've been working on, or the magnetometer module itself?
Magnetometers in general, from what I understand, they have a low-pass filter, which means a static magnetic field could create an issue. You could probably, if you have something that's not changing at all, you could probably calibrate that out. But you don't have to worry so much about things like radio antennas and other fast-moving electromagnetic fields that have a magnetic component.
Okay, I see what you're saying. I can't speak to that because that, presumably if some of that's designed into the ASIC that... that is manufactured by the supplier.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure of it. Yes.
On a very large scale, one question is, Dave KVOS was mentioning that the reason some of these geomagnetic people were interested in putting a magnetometer here in town, the reason this woman has been here, is due to some sort of a magnetic anomaly that they're interested in that seems to be present in this part of the country. And they were, I don't know, they were studying it. I don't know much about that, but presumably if it's unchanging, it's not going to affect our results too much.
We probably ought to come to this discussion when we have the yeoman on the line.
Nathaniel?
Yeah, go ahead.
There is a paper that was in Space Weather Quarterly, and it had the U.S. with a bunch of dots on it, but there were no dots in the Southwest or Texas. Do you remember that figure?
Is this a magnetometer paper?
Yes.
No, I don't remember that specific figure.
I can get that paper for you, but there were local anomalies in the Midwest from Missouri north. There was no sampling in Arkansas, so the PI of the project was targeting Arkansas as the next place to look. And there was anomalies running up and down the Appalachians as well.
Okay, that sounds good.
Interestingly, none in the Rockies.
Interesting. Regarding the question that was going on before, as to whether or not these other materials are going to affect it, yeah, Dave, I can't remember. Did the module itself from the company say that it was sensitive to static fields?
Really, their documentation, such as it is, doesn't go into that particularly. I'm real familiar with other devices I've looked at, you know, discussing extensively, you know, especially on robots and things, zeroing out both soft and hard, I don't know, sources that confuse the issue.
Okay, yeah, I would guess that the documentation from the manufacturer would be the best source of information on that.
I'll have a look again. I've been worrying about pinouts, not some of the bigger issues.
Yeah, I don't remember what it said exactly for that specific module.
I just took a quick look. It said keep it away from large ferrous things, keep it away from large changing fields, and keep it away from tantalum capacitors.
I remember the part about tantalum capacitors.
What is that about?
It doesn't say.
Tantalum magnetic?
So tantalum capacitors don't like magnetic fields?
No, I think the other way around. Are tantalum capacitors actually magnetic?
Maybe that they're just bad.
Which magnetometer is this? What's the unit?
This is the PNI RM3100 module.
Yes.
I expect I'll be looking to put this in my side yard before too awfully long, which is, you know, open for at least a 50-foot, maybe larger radius in all directions. Away from my house, you know, when I get somebody to help me, I'm getting a little crotchety to do some of these things myself. But when I do that, maybe I'll start putting up some numbers I capture.
Scotty, did you say that you had some questions on the receiver?
Yeah. Did you pay special attention to the 5 volts and how he routed it through the center there? Did that look okay?
Yeah, I think so. You're talking about the wiring to the relays?
Yeah, because it looks like you put a tab in the middle, isolated from the analog grounds. It was a 5-volt ground that he works the relays against.
Yeah, that's what I've got, and it looks like it was all isolated. You know, it's hard to tell when you have each artwork layer on a separate pane, but as far as I could tell, they appear isolated.
Do you have a Gerber viewer? So I'll get him to send us the Gerber so we can look at him all layered.
Oh gosh, if I do, I haven't used it in many years.
You can download a free one. I use GC Preview, GCPREVUE.
Okay, I remember the name. I'm sure I installed that. I don't know if it's on this computer or the predecessor, but I'll take a look at that. It'd be nice to have something where I can X-ray through and see if the ground planes or power planes overlap anywhere, but I didn't think they did when we were on the call, but it'd be nice to have X-ray vision.
Yeah, with GC Preview, you can click on planes and turn layers on and off at will, so you can compare layer 1 to layer 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 independently.
Okay, go ahead and send me the Gerbers and I'll figure it out.
Okay, I haven't got him yet. Dave has him, but once we get done with all the annotation and all that, he's going to want to renumber the board. And so he's going to send me a renumber file. And I'm going to, it's an automated process. We run it against the ORCAD file, and it renumbers all the refdeses.
Okay. Will that create XA10?
That will create XA10.
Okay. I'll wait for XA10.
And then we can get the Gerbers that will match that. And we can do a little more study if you want before we run off and make boards.
Okay. Very good. You know, when we look at it online, I thought it looked pretty good, but it doesn't hurt to double check.
Yeah, do you think we need another online meeting, or do you think we're set?
I think we're set. I wouldn't, right now, I don't know any additional questions to ask.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, if we're in between other topics, I had a question for Rob about WhisperNet database he's talking about.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, well, I've played around with making databases for use for analyzing spot data quite a bit. And I have come to have a distaste for trying to do anything utilizing any kind of something like MySQL or something like that, a hierarchical database, because when you start getting large collections, the search time starts getting very slow. So we have been talking about the possibility of doing something with one of the cloud services and using one of the Hadoop or one of those type of cloud analysis packages, which is when you work with those, you store all your data as sequential files, and then you spread the sequential files out across a great number of servers, maybe 1,000 servers. I mean, if you have, I've got about 5 terabytes of this data so far. And I would probably spread it out across 1,000 servers and then trigger where you have 1,000 servers go and do their search. And then what you do then is aggregate the results. I'm not sure if that is the kind of thing you're thinking about, but there's various different flavors of how you do that. You can do something like that on Amazon Web Services. The problem is that you don't know in advance how much it's going to cost. And you can put $30,000 on your credit card in a matter of a day or two if you're not careful. Now, we do have a Visual Studio license at the university, which allows each of us to do $150 worth of computing without any additional cost. A lot of people gag when they hear Microsoft come into the picture. I'm just thinking about that in terms of self-preservation, in terms of trying to control the cost. But anyway, we do have a team here at University of Alabama that's going to be thinking about what to do about the database for the personal space weather station, and we're certainly interested in other people's perspectives. So go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, I know so little about this, but you know, the WhisperNet database, as I said, is a pretty good test source. So what we're trying to do is, my understanding is WhisperNet itself is based upon a MySQL database, and they really don't allow you to query the database. They have only the most rudimentary queries that you can make. So we've experimented to see, well, first off, we're gathering a lot more data now and want to record it with the spots. I mean, with my software package, we're able to gather the background noise level at the same time as we get the spots. And in addition, we wanted to calculate the path between the transmit and receive sites and record that so you could do some queries based upon that information. So we did pretty well with there. I don't have any budget for this. This is self-funded. So what I did was there are two databases that are optimized for this class of time series ordered data. One is called Influx, and the other is called Time. It's escaping me at the moment. The Influx is a ground up. They built their own database that is. Has been around for 4 or 5 years, and I set it up, well, started in the cloud service, When we ran out of memory, you know, I think I paid for 8 gigabytes of RAM, but performance was poor because of the virtualization and of the CPU out there. So I moved it and just put I have a Xeon server here in my office, and we put it on this, and this thing runs lickety split. I mean, we put in, I don't know, we had something like 60 million records and could do fairly complex queries and get answers back in, 100 milliseconds. So that was promising until we discovered that this database is very sensitive to cardinality of the data, index data. And this may not be a problem for space weather, but for the WhisperNet, there, you know, you would think most part of the indexes are the transmit sites, call sign and grid location. But there's a lot of balloon data in the WhisperNet where the transmit ID stays the same, but the grid location moves. And that balloon data completely hoses the, once we added a bunch, got back a couple weeks and there was a balloon flying through, the cardinality got so terrible that queries would take minutes and run out of memory. So there's we're looking at this other database, which I got a response from Josh Vega from the Reflector, and he's suggested Timescale. That's the name of it, and it's based upon Postgres. But it adds a meta layer, and we're considering, they claim it's kind of not subject to those kinds of performance limitations. And, I'm a little out of my depth here, but I've been working with my partner on this, Gwen Griffiths, has been doing some these performance metrics and generating some very interesting, motion graphics about vector paths from WhisperNet data, looking at time of day and where the max the northernmost vertices were for paths, transmission paths. So we got some interesting results, and I think we're now hopefully it's just that either we have to exclude the balloon data, or we have to look at another database. So we're trying first to exclude the balloon data. I don't know if this is relevant for the space weather station project, where I think the primary indices, being recording site, receiving site, and its location, and the other parameters that would be the primary indices would not be changing. So maybe this cardinality issue isn't so significant. But if you're not limited by that, I think these databases will go up into the terabytes and so on with very good performance. So I'm sure there are, other solutions like the ones you describe. They sound like they would cost a lot of money. And so I couldn't go in that direction. I don't know if we had, perhaps with the funding for this project, maybe that isn't such a consideration. But my plan was if we can do this with our own servers, to put a pair of servers at redundancy at a couple of different co-locations, and use those as my as a kind of alternative shadow WhisperNet database. So that's the direction I'm going in, and all this data I'm going to make it available to anyone. So if this is of interest to any of your students there, I'd welcome someone who would like to collaborate with us, who has more time than Gwen and I have to look into it.
Well, I've got data. I've got PSK Reporter, Reverse Beacon Network, the DX Cluster, and RBN going back almost 5 years. And the database is definitely unwieldy as it is, and we're talking with MIT Haystack about putting it on the Madrigal, at least a copy of it, putting it up on the Madrigal system so that it could be widely available to everybody. As far as what's going to work best for the type of analysis you want to do, we probably need to get together offline and spend quite some time discussing that, because
be great. I would love to learn from you, and Gwen would too. So yes, please, you have my email contact, rob@robinet.us. will reach me, and I'll put it in here just so that have it here. I don't have permission to send. Oh, I think I was on the wrong channel. That's
it on QR. I see it on QRZ.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you can find it there. That's, anyway, yes, please contact me. We'd love to get together and have a meeting and learn from you. And you know, perhaps we can waste less of our own time. And we can share with you the kind of queries and analyses that Gwen has been, extracting from the WhisperNet data that we've been gathering. We are publishing a paper in QEX sometime this year. They've accepted it. I don't know when they're going to publish it. That is derived from the kind of some of the first generation of data that we gathered, that I think I may have discussed at the September meeting, where we think we were observing some TIDs and be able to extract them from the measurements we're making with the.
Yeah, that's very good. And one thing that I think we might want to think about is trying to compare the results shown by we've got four different data sources now. And one thing that I have found is that the different data sources use different modes of transmission, which are more or less sensitive to different kinds of things. For example, one of the forms of transmission, I think it might be WhisperNet, uses a very long transmission window on the order of a couple of minutes.
It does. That's Whisper, yeah.
Yeah, and fast-moving stuff like the fading you get, for example, on 6 meters, you won't get a signal report through that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, but you will on some other things. So it's really interesting to compare that, because I think you can learn additional stuff just like looking at that.
Yeah, yeah. That's we've been focused mostly on the shortwave, 2,200 meters through 10 meters, this is just our first exploration into this subject matter. Really, it was stimulated by my visit to attending the conference last year, stimulated my interest and Gwen's interest in exploring this from WhisperNet data. So we do have a network of sites that are gathering additional data and recording it to our database, which we're cloning, we're scraping the WhisperNet data, and we're adding from our own sites, we add to the data some other parameters that we gather at our sites. So we have a whole host of potential receive sites out there that are using my Whisper Daemon software and can extract this additional noise level and other parameters out of the recordings. So we've got a kind of a network in place, and we have a database, our first stabs, experimentations with databases. But this is a area that we don't know a lot about, but it's the area of our active, and welcome your guidance.
It's great to actually have somebody who's going to be an initial user on this, because your perspective on this will be useful.
I can deploy this stuff and start recording live data, with other things. If people had other things, the Whisper Daemon is taking the WAV files that are recorded from whatever the receiver is, the 2 minute long receive files, and it's right now extracting two things. It's extracting the spots, JTX does. And it's also extracting the background noise level, which is something we've added. But we've got these 2 minute long recordings. We could subject them to other forms of processing and other forms of analysis to extract other information. And I would hope you know, that with the Tangerine that we would be able to add magnetometer data or whatever the other other data sources are in at the Tangerine SDR sites. So, I'm trying to make a Whisper Daemon software package that's generalized enough that it can be utilized for a wide range of observations. So.
I posted there a link to a ranking of time series DBMSs, probably not all relevant to this purpose, but just if someone's curious about the general subject.
Oh, yes. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. That's as I say, we've run into a very serious weakness of influx. So I'm, for use with WhisperNet data, I think it's pretty much either you have to throw away a significant number of the observations, or it's just unusable beyond 2 weeks data.
I want to mention we are past our time.
So anyway, please email me and I'd like to continue on with
Rob, any chance you're going to be at the HAMSCI workshop in Scranton?
I'm scheduled to come, but I have to say I'm still recovering from a flu that I was not COVID-19, and I'm a little hesitant about traveling. I'm reconsidering all my travel plans, including that.
Yeah, I have the same thing. I got some kind of problem with my lungs that goes back a couple of years, and I've already canceled one vacation trip. I was planning to do a 2-week drive through California, but I've been going to put that off for at least a year. But the things that I'm committed to are, I don't feel right canceling unless, in the case that the university tells me I can't travel for university business, then I won't have the option, but we shall see.
Well, I'm at the age where I'm a member of a high risk group.
Oh, same here.
My 70s. Same here. So, that gives me pause about, you know, I'm not really required to travel for anything. So I'm rethinking it. I don't think we have any. We were going to give a demonstration of what we're doing, but I'm not a regular scheduled speaker, so I don't think my absence wouldn't disrupt the program.
And it might be possible to do it via Zoom too.
I'm online all the time. It works better for me almost than being in, because my one infirmity of age is my hearing is poor. So these online sessions are marvelous with the headset.
All right, we'll come back to that topic. Dave, back to you.
I wanted to mention to Nathaniel that I posted a paper that has the map I was talking about, but not the colors indicating the anomalies.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I see that link there.
So Dolores is working with some other scientists to fill in the southwest sector of that map.
Very good. So is each of those blue dots is a site?
Well, it's where measurements have been taken. The stars are actual sites, but somebody has traveled to all the other places and taken some extensive magnetometer readings.
Okay, because a couple years ago I was in Antarctica, I met a guy down there who's actually a ham also, and he was one of the jobs that he had at one point was going and installing magnetometers in a grid all across the U.S. for geological purposes.
Yeah, these blue dots, well, they were relating them to anomalies in the electrical system as well, which is the orange lines.
Okay, very good.
I think what I was seeing was a paper that has not been published yet.
Okay.
So look for future information.
I will do that.
Well, any other comments? We're at our time. If there's something burning that needs to be taken care of, let's do it.
Well, I think we're good, Dave. Thanks again for running everything.
Well, you're welcome.
Well, thanks, Dave, and we'll see everybody next week.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Good night, 73.
Thank you all.
73.
User disconnected from your channel. User disconnected from your channel.
Dan, I want to tell you, even though from your channel. I figured it out myself, I appreciate having you to ask questions
user
about.
Disconnected from your channel.
Well, that's okay. User disconnected from your channel. Yeah, I haven't really used PyHPSDR for quite a while, so I couldn't do a job of answering the question you asked.
Well, what the main deal was, I had compiled it several years before LinHPSDR was available, and I was quite good. And then I compiled it, and it the default settings, the way they put it up, assumes that you're using the device that Apache Labs sells. And it took me a little while to figure out how to turn off those settings and put it back the way it was.
Okay, so you did figure it out. Yeah, well, my whole purpose in using the Raspberry Pi 4 was really more to investigate the performance of the Raspberry Pi 4 rather than looking for something that actually, some software, radio software that actually worked.
I'm amazed. It does work quite well. Probably the NVIDIA is a little better, but this is not bad. And it is, I think it does not have the problem of the pops that you were having on the old Droid.
No, it could be. I know that when I used the Raspberry Pi 4, it cleaned up a lot of the pops that I was having with the IQ2. So I'm not sure. It's still, I still thought on, with LinHPSDR that the CPU usage is pretty high. It was running around 55% to 65%.
Yeah. And there are some potentials for, efficient use of the cores that are available seems to be an issue with some of the software. And so there may be some gains to be had there. Scotty, I have an interesting thing that I noticed when I was going through this code of John Melton's. He built into his Pi a firmware loader.
Oh, so does he use the standard commands that you use?
Well, I mean, basically, I haven't figured out where the links are in the interface, but I found the code in there, and the code is virtually identical to the old programmer he wrote many years ago, although cleaned up.
Well, it's an FPGA programmer, right?
Yeah, he wrote the HPSDR, the original HPSDR programmer, but he had written it in a way that solved a problem that he and Phil had, and it was terribly confusing to most people who either didn't program or didn't deal with OpenHPSDR all the time. So what I had done was took his program and made one that was, I basically broke the two parts apart so that one would just update your code and another one would solve some problems. And those two, it was really confusing to people which one they were using and why.
Okay, but you say that's built into his PyHPSDR program?
Well, I don't know, but the code, there is four little modules in there that have to do with that. And when I looked at the code, it was very familiar stuff. So I'm going to check that against what I have, because what I was working off was some 2012 or 13 code that John had written and not updated. So I want to see what, if this stuff is virtually the same or if he's cleaned it up. And by the way, I was thinking of rewriting it in Go so that just to make sure that I could reproduce it and test it. But we could also use this other code too, if that's what we want to do.
Is his in C or in Python?
Straight C. No pluses, no sharps.
Okay.
I just thought I'd wait for tell you this because it isn't really terribly important to the project right now, but it's going to be in the near future.
I think what I want to do on the FPGA code is when I get a chance, I want to build in the bootloader into the IQ2. You have a way to reload the IQ2?
Well, I've used the one on the A9 before.
Can plug into the programming port and fire up the Cortis tools and load a JIC file, right?
Yes, I've done that in the past. I'd have to refresh my memory.
Okay, so if I sent you a JIC file with a bootloader in it, then we could test your new code.
Yes, that would be helpful. Also, I had a weird question that I was getting from Phil. He was wanting to find how many lines are on the Max 10. And I did find some data that had how many were there. It didn't appear. He wanted 28 by 3 LVDS lines. And he wanted his old DFC used GX modules to be able to put it to a SATA. You basically run a Linux, and then he could read those ports directly as a dev file, a dev in the Linux machine. So it made it very convenient. But I noticed that Cyclone 4 and 5 have the GX designator. I cannot find one that had a Max 10 that has the GX designator. They seem to have switched over to DDR.
Max 10s don't have transceivers. The GX, GS, and GT, actually it's GX and GT, I believe, because the S is the SOC versions, and then there's an SX and ST, and there's a GX and GT. And the ones with the G's and the S's, sorry, I get this right, the G's and the T's have SerDes transceivers on them, and that's different than LVDS lanes.
LVDS lanes talk direct DR memory?
Yes, they can. They can talk, let me put it a different way. If you have a DDR controller on the part, then you have to use particular banks of I/O to talk to the actual DDR chips.
Okay, well that makes sense, but it may not comment about using Cortis 18.1. That was very helpful.
Okay, good. Is it working for you?
Yes.
Yeah, so use your chopping out a little bit there. I'm not exactly sure what Phil was asking that he wanted to be able to do.
Well, he's trying to take the old DFC code and update it to some new configuration, and we're trying to figure out, well, what's... Because that was written, most of that stuff was written 4 years ago, and FPGAs have changed a few bit in 4 years.
So he wants to use the Max 10, maybe use the data engine and do DFC on it?
Well, he hasn't been talking about your data engine, but he's talked about a Max 10 as a FPGA. And it's like all these different little projects are swirling around, and I'm trying to figure out as much as I can without turning into an FPGA programmer.
Oh, come on. We need more FPGA programmers.
I prefer a slightly higher language myself.
Anyway, so the problem with asking how many lanes it has is on Max 10s, it depends on the package type. And there are basically, there's really four package types. There's a real El Cheapo type, which is 144-pin part. Then there's the 256-pin part, the 484, and the 672, I believe it is the next one. So, and they have a significantly different number of IOs.
Well, I have that development board, and it's the 484 GES numbers, 10 M5 Q DAF 484, looks like a 06 GES.
It would be a MAX 10, DAF probably, Delta Alpha Foxtrot 484.
Yes, and that's the development board that I bought that you'd recommended.
Yeah, that's the one. We both have that board. Yeah, the D is the dual supply, which is really ironic because it's more like three or four supplies. And the A has the A to D converters on it, and the F484 is the package type.
That 484 seemed to be one of the ones with more lanes coming out than most of them.
Yeah, that's the mid-grade package. They have several of them smaller. They have only one larger than that. Well, in the MAX 10 anyway.
Well, I'm trying to learn enough to be able to be helpful and do what I can, and also understand how to essentially for the programmer that I'm talking about, I just need to know how to get to the flash memory and how to put it in there, and I want to be sure that we write it in a way that does some checking. Like a proper CRC.
Yeah, and I think that's what your latest code does, right? Even though it may be a few years old.
It does some of that, but not all of. That was the big thing when they started getting into Protocol 2. They found that it was not consistent from device to device how it worked, where the other stuff was slower and less. They didn't really, if you got it to work, it worked, and if it didn't work, it didn't work at all. Now the newer boards, it'll load, but some will work and some won't, and that's what's caused some problems.
Okay, the 484 part gives you 500 IOs, 30 LVDS transmitters. Let's see, transmitters or receivers, I'm looking to see which. 30 and 136. I believe that the 30 is, if I remember, it's actual transmitters. And you can simulate transmitters on more of them, but you have to use external terminating resistors. And you get 100 on the 672, you get 24 and 136 and 360 IOs. On the 672, you get 500 IOs. With 30 LVDS transmitters and 192 receivers.
Ah, yes. I did find that data sheet that has all the different FPGAs and what the parts were.